Welcome, dear Sangha. How's the sound? Okay, I'm taking that to mean it's good. So my dog is also deciding that this is a good time to make sound. So let's hope that it stays to a minimal, doesn't interrupt too much. So here we are in our retreat together. From all over Puerto Rico, Brazil, all over the United States, and a lot of us here in California. How amazing it is that we can bring our practice together. And the Buddha, in the teachings, the Buddha went to many different places and told stories. The Buddha was an amazing storyteller when you read through the suttas, all of the parables and the similes that bring the teaching to life. And when the Buddha offers us these stories, we begin to see the fabric of who it was that was practicing. You know, sometimes the Buddha was talking to kings, and sometimes the Buddha was talking to cowherds, courtesans, acrobats, musicians, charioteers, merchants, potters. And then, of course, there were all sorts of stories about animals. And so we can see through the richness of the Buddha's teachings, the vibrancy of the when he lived. And I think one of the powerful things about stories is how they can touch and inspire us and move us to connect deeply, not only with our own stories, but others as well. And so we can see how we are similar, and then that which is universal. And so as we practice, we often touch into our own stories. They arise in our practice. And tonight we'll speak to wise reflection. How is it that we can reflect and bring these stories and our own personal experiences into our practice, how we can practice with them as we have this inner knowing of our own hearts and minds, which is essential. Many of you know that I taught elementary school for many years, and my mother was also a kindergarten teacher, so I was raised on lots of stories. So I love stories. And you know, because I was raised pre-internet, books were actually the way that I learned about the world. And, you know, I went to the library every week and got new books. And I loved the stories that told about kids in different countries, because it helped me know that there was a world outside of my world. And this is one of my favorite quotes about the power of stories. James Baldwin says, "You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read. It was books that taught me that the things that tormented me most were the very things that connected me with all the people who were alive and who had ever been alive." That way that our individual stories can connect with these more universal stories, and that the depth of those stories can bring our aliveness. And I think that perhaps we can say, you know, you think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented, but then you practice. But then you practice this and you realize what it means to be human. This condition of suffering for people who are alive. So tonight I want to share a story from the suttas. This is from the Majjhima Nikayas, and it's a sutta of an exchange between the Buddha and Venerable Rahula. And many of you may know that Venerable Rahula was the Buddha's son. And so this was sutta was told to Rahula when he was about 7 years old, shortly after joining the monastic order. And so in the commentaries, it says that this the Buddha offered this story to Rahula because Rahula was careless with his speech. So what it said is that when the Buddha was present and someone came to ask Rahula and said, "Is the Buddha here?" The Rahula answered mischievously, "No, he's not here." I mean, have that happened to you when you were the kid, when you're standing right next to them? They're like, "No, he's not. They're not there." And then when the Buddha was absent and someone asked Rahula, "Is the Buddha here?" The Rahula answered mischievously, "The Buddha is here." So here's the Buddha. Rahula is a new monastic, also his son. And the Buddha is going to offer instructions to Rahula. And so I find these instructions to be very telling and very tender and very kind. So the sutta starts off, as so many others have. And once again, for those of you who are interested, this is Majjhima Nikaya 61. "Thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel's feeding ground. Then late in the afternoon, the Buddha came out of retreat and went to see Venerable Rahula. Rahula saw the Buddha coming off in the distance. He spread out a seat and placed water for washing the feet." This is very similar to how so many of the stories start, right? And then the Buddha begins to expound on the importance of ethics. And I really love this because the Buddha doesn't just go like, "You should this, that." The Buddha takes the pot that had been used for the washing the water, and there's a little bit of water in it. And the Buddha says to Rahula, "Do you see this little bit of water left in the pot?" And Rahula says, "Yes." And the Buddha says, "That's how little of the practitioner's nature is left in those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie." And he continues to go on using this pot to illustrate ethics. And then at the end, he turns the pot upside down. And the Buddha says, "Do you see how this pot is turned upside down?" And the Buddha says, "That's how the practitioner's nature is turned upside down in those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie." And so to me, this is so illustrative of how useful it is to have specific examples, how discombobulated one can feel when one has said something that's untrue. And so I love this story, the beginning of the story. We're going to continue with it because the Buddha models so clearly the impact of telling a lie, like what it means, like you feel turned upside down or you feel empty. And he also does it in such a way that it's tender and compassionate, not judgmental. So the Buddha begins this encounter with Rahula by reminding Rahula the importance of integrity, of sila, of ethics. And for all of us, the first day when we came on retreat, we focused on sila, we focused on ethics, we focused on the importance of having that foundation to what we're doing. That this is a wholehearted practice, that we align ourselves with integrity, you know, by taking the precepts that were offered by Mary Grace, and really taking them into our heart. It's not to be taken lightly. It's really such a precious community where we are all leaning towards each other with this intention towards non-harming. For so many of us, we've had experiences with humans that have been harmful. And so to be in a community where we are all turning and aligning ourselves to trying to practice non-harming can really help to disrupt the climates of distrust and fear that we may have accumulated through our lifetime. And as we offer this gift to ourselves and other of non-harming, we can begin to allow an opening and letting go into the container and the freedom that comes from holding the precepts. A teacher who you may know, Tenasara, who's a Western Buddhist teacher who ordained with Ajahn Chah, she speaks the importance of each of us upholding sila, ethics, integrity. She says, an inner ethic maintains values that are deeply resonant with the interconnectedness of everything, an appreciation of causality, and a sense of care for the whole web of life. An inner ethic needs to be guided by wise reflection, enabling the negotiation of complexity, including the many gray areas of daily life. So I really like how she points to integrity and sila is tied into this interconnectedness of everything. And when we offered the precepts, Mary Grace pointed this out, that we were offering them for ourselves and for the community. And yet, even with those precepts, there's this need for a wise reflection to negotiate the complexity of what it means to uphold those precepts. And even for us in this retreat where we have pared down our activity, there still is daily life creeping in, especially since we're many of us are in our homes negotiating housemates and other people who we live with and other things that may be happening in the home. And so these are the gray areas that arise, that this wise reflection that Tenasara points to is so essential to how do we engage. And so I want to focus tonight on this aspect of wise reflection, which forms the framework for the rest of the sutta. And that's the main focus that I'll be talking about. And wise reflection, once we have established, as we have for the past few days, of our continuity of practice and gathering our mindfulness and begin to settle in, we can bring in this area of wise reflection to work with what's arising in our practice. And so we can think about the context that we're in and what's arising, what are the patterns that we see. And so when we go back to the sutta, we can realize, and we look at Rahula, you know, we think he's 7 years old. And so that's one of the reasons why I love these instructions, because I'm like, okay, great. This might be good for me. You know, like, let me start at the beginning. This is instructions for Rahula, who's 7. There we go. All right. And he was new to being in community and he was learning. And sometimes I think as an adult, I think, oh, I'm done. I've got this, you know, I'm not learning. And yet, you know, don't we know that we are all learning? And so in this sutta, I love how the Buddha, you know, it doesn't start the conversation off with Rahula by criticizing him and judging him. He shares like very concrete, specific examples. And that invites Rahula into this process of learning. Really recognizing that mistakes are part of the path. Mistakes are part of the path. They're not like, oops, let me get back over here. They are the path. There's a wonderful talk by Pema Chodron about, and this is the title of her talk, if you look for it, fail, fail, fail better. And so let me just share a little bit. The whole talk is fabulous. And let me just share a little bit of her talk. She says, if there is one skill that is not stressed very much, but is really needed, it is knowing how to fail well. The fine art of failing. There's a lot of emphasis on succeeding, and whether we buy the hype or not, we all want to succeed, especially if you consider success as it works out the way I want it to. So failing by that definition is that it didn't work out the way you wanted it to. And failing is what we don't usually get a lot of preparation for. So she says, fail, fail again, fail better. It's like how to get good at holding the rawness of vulnerability in your heart, or how to get good at welcoming the unwelcome. Let me repeat that part. So fail, fail again, fail better. It's like how to get good at holding the rawness of vulnerability in your heart, or how to get good at welcoming the unwelcome. And she continues, can you allow yourself to feel what you feel when things don't go the way you want them to, when things don't go the way you hoped and wished for and longed for them to go? And even on our retreats, sometimes we expect, we have a certain expectation for the trajectory of the retreat. And generally those expectations include, you know, something that's pleasant and going well. And how she says, it works out the way I want it to. Maybe that calm abiding that we don't have in our daily life. And can we welcome the unwelcome? Can we allow ourselves to feel what is happening when things don't go the way we want them to? So this is part of our practice of mindfulness, is a part of welcoming. It's really this invitation to welcome ourselves, all of ourselves. And I love how the word attention has the word tend in it. And so I think of this practice of mindfulness, of coming back, of tending, like a garden, like Mary Grace was talking about all these seeds that we're planting. So can we, rather than think of ourselves as this super highway going somewhere, but like a garden that we're tending, sometimes raw and vulnerable, falling and failing and experiencing things we weren't anticipating over and over again, all these seasons of our lives, practicing with the way things are rather than trying to control and make things the way we want them to be. So this sounds all well and good. And so in the Buddha's instructions to Rahula, the Buddha actually gives specifics about how do we do this wise reflection? How do we tend? How do we attend to this mindfulness, this way of bringing about? How do we orient our lives? And so the first thing the Buddha brings up and says to Rahula, what is the purpose of a mirror? A mirror, you know, and imagine maybe the Buddha had a mirror there, I'm not sure, but and the Rahula says it's for the purpose of reflection. And then the Buddha says, so too, Rahula, an action with the body should be done after repeated reflection. An action of speech should be done after repeated reflection. An action of the mind should be done after repeated reflection. So then the sutta speaks to reflection. And reflections on the actions of the body, actions of the speech, and actions in the mind. And these are the guidelines that the Buddha offers. And so this is starts off with before, during, and after. And so we're going to go through some of it. We might not get through the before, during, and after, but each one of these reflections can happen before, during, or after. So at any point, just like when we were giving the instructions, at any point that you wake up, you can reflect. So starting off with the body, the Buddha says, when you want to act with the body, you should reflect. Does this act with the body that I want to do lead to harming myself, harming others, or harming both? So there's self, others, and both. So in each action, we're making this reflection. Is it unskillful with suffering as its outcome and result? If while reflecting in this way, you know, this act with the body that I want to do leads to harming myself, harming others, or harming both, it's unskillful with suffering as its outcome. To the best of your ability, Rahula, you should not do such a deed. But if while reflecting in this way, you know, this act with the body that I want to do doesn't lead to harming myself, harming others, or harming both, it's skillful with happiness as its outcome and result, then, Rahula, you should do such a deed. So I just want to look a little bit more deeply at this passage here to see what's being said. And first, let's consider the word reflection. And I love the word reflection because the image of a mirror is just reflecting what is there. Not saying, compare yourself to the person next to you or compare yourself to this norm of what should be happening. Not judging, not valuing. A reflection to the best of our ability, we try to see what is here with, you know, interest, but not with this analytical inquiry where we're trying to categorize. And then we direct that reflection at what is skillful or unskillful to both ourselves, others, and both. So our community. Not just the individual, like, oh, this is good for me. Or I'm going to do it because that person needs this and I really need to help them. Because then there's the both. So we use that as part of our reflection. And then the third part of the reflection is to reflect through the lens of wholesome or unwholesome, often translated as skillful or unskillful. In this case, this word wholesome or unwholesome, the word for unwholesome is akusala, A-K-U-S-A-L-A in Pali. And in that, how do we know? What's the guide for what is unwholesome? And so we look to the three unwholesome roots. And we look and we reflect to see if what's happening has any of these roots of greed or hatred or delusion arising. And we reflect to see if our action is bringing about any of those results. And then kusala, so it's without the A, K-U-S-A-L-A, is wholesome or skillful. And so then in kusala, that's when we have accompanied by these wholesome roots. And so that would be non-greed or generosity and non-hatred or loving kindness. Non-delusion or wisdom. And so these instructions have been very useful to me in knowing how to attend. Where do I put my attention? What should I attend to? And so when I'm thinking about will my acts increase suffering or bring about happiness, I can think about through this lens of am I bringing about generosity and kindness and wisdom? Or am I feeling that moving in that direction, I'll feel more greedy. I'm a little more, you know, aversion and more confusion. And as with all of these processes, it's not a striving into, but a gathering and a gradual path, as was spoken to. And in this way, I'm inclining my mind, paying attention to the presence or the absence of these skillful or wholesome states. And so the Buddha tells Rahula, you can reflect before you do the action, and then you can reflect during the action as well. And so during the reaction, you can, if you reflect and you realize it's unskillful, then in the very middle of it, you can stop. Oh, I think I better stop this now. And we know that when we're practicing, sometimes we realize we get lost and we're boom, ooh. I'm thinking, you know, you realize before you know it that you're heading off in a direction, you bring yourself back. And then after, sometimes something will happen and then there'll be that residue. I don't know if this has happened to you, but sometimes there's a residue in the body and then the thought arises of something that just happened afterwards. And so the Buddha encourages us and says, does this act with the body that you have done lead to harming yourself, others, or both? And so what the Buddha suggests that you do after is, Buddha says, if you feel something's been unskillful, then Rahula, you should confess, reveal, and clarify such a deed to the teacher or a sensible spiritual companion. And having revealed it, you should restrain yourself in the future. So I love this sense of wise companionship on the path that we can share and we can support each other in sharing. Like I'm not sure this happened. You're like, how, help me with some guidance here. And then the Buddha continues and says, if the act with the body that you've done doesn't lead to harming, it's skillful with happiness as its outcome and result, then Rahula, you should live in rapture and joy because of this, training day and night in skillful qualities. And so I love this as well, because the Buddha is encouraging us to actually feel into that sense of the goodness of what we're doing. So remembering like, oh, right, that was a good choice. That made that happiness for myself and others. So I wanted to share a story about a time that I was practicing, and I was practicing in Burma, and I was a period of time that it was unseasonably warm there. And I was practicing in this monastery where we had very long meditation periods in the afternoon when it was quite, quite warm. It was like over 100 degrees with 90 to 100% humidity. Some went up to 114 one day. It was really, really hot. So I was practicing with the body, lots of sweat, dripping, heat, hot, you know. And the meditation hall was just beautiful. It had these beautiful shiny wooden floors and a Buddha statue and lots of windows. And so there was windows, and the air that was outside was the same as the air that was inside. Very, very hot. And then on the ceiling, there were these rows and rows of fans, spotless fans. And I'm practicing and feeling the sensations of the body and wondering how hot it needs to get for them to turn the fans on. It's just like, why aren't they turning the fans on? And, you know, I just sit there sweating and dripping and sweating. It's connecting with the body. And I just, all I could think about was these fans. Like, why? Are their fans work? Is there a let, you know, what's going on? And so I had practice meetings with the abbot of the monastery about every other day. And there was another English speaking person there from Taiwan. And one day she asked the abbot about the fans. And I was so grateful because I didn't want to ask, because I was, you know, like I was thinking it, but I was not going to name it. And so she asked the abbot, well, when will you turn the fans on? You know, wondering, you know, I was just really, really excited to hear, like, if it was a possibility to turn the fans on. And he looked at us and he said, you Westerners, you want to use the energy and resources to change your circumstances when you could use the power of your mind. Use the power of your mind. Mic drop, right? So all I was focusing on was, you know, can't you change these circumstances? That's greed arising. Whereas if I use the power of my mind, the capacity of my mind, Like, so my desire was for just a comfort, and he really put it in, you know, here we are, here I am, you know, someone from the U.S., from a very wealthy country that uses lots of resources, used to comfort, coming to Burma, wanting them to turn the fans on, using resources for my comfort. And this practice of renunciation, so beautiful, of taking what is given, the unpleasant sensation of the heat, not really that much of a big deal, sweat, drink some water. And I recognized in my reflection is that the particularities of me being from the U.S., in Burma and wanting the fans on to use more energy in this world and this planet, like, we're not considering climate change or anything like that. And so this practice of reflection can bring us into a skillful way of attending, a kind of pausing that we can bring in before an action, during an action, or after an action. So in that pause, we can begin to notice the inclination of the mind that we talked about. It's the mind inclined towards that wanting and greed. It's the mind inclined towards aversion or delusion. And we can bring in that pause, we can bring it into the body. You know, if it is, if we're feeling, oh, I really want the fans, what does that feel like in the body to experience that? And then can I bring in the generosity, the kindness, the skillful qualities? How can I incline the mind towards generosity and kindness for myself, for others, and for both? And I found this practice so helpful during retreat because I think that when we slow things down, sometimes we can begin to see some of the thought patterns and the habit patterns of mind that can illustrate some of the places that we're caught. And so many of the places that we're caught are places that are around identities or stories that have been with us for a long time. And the thing that I love about being on retreat is that sometimes we think that the things that will be the most important have to be these big ahas, and really they can be small things like the fans or this other story that I want to share about a retreat that I was on in person. So my apologies for sharing about a retreat in person, but it was about how baked potatoes like helped me awaken. So this retreat was at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. And when I'm on retreat, I often take the 8 precepts, which includes not eating after lunch. And so, you know, just like so many of us, you know, I organized my retreat so that during the dinner time, I would do yoga and so that I was occupied, so I wouldn't be so distracted by the mealtime. But nonetheless, the yoga room was right near the dining hall in Massachusetts. And so I walked through the dining hall after I did my yoga and I smelled what they were having. And immediately I had this barrage of thoughts. You know, first of all, I was indignant because the evening meal is supposed to be a light dinner, generally soup and crackers. And I was thinking baked potatoes are not light. This is a heavy meal. And then second of all, it was a baked potato bar. They had baked potatoes with all of these toppings. And so, you know, I was just like, they're not following the rules. Baked potatoes should not be happening at dinner time. This is not what's happening. And then next thought was, I love potatoes. And, you know, so really it wasn't about them, was it? It wasn't about them and their baked potatoes. It was about me. And I wasn't getting these baked potatoes. And then the next thought was like, I'm Irish. I should be having these baked potatoes. How could they have baked potatoes without me? This is not correct. I don't understand why they're not having baked potatoes for lunch. I need to be included. And I could feel that sense of exclusion based and the sense of ownership. These baked potatoes were mine. And this whole story arose based on these baked potatoes. And the beauty of being on retreat was that I began to see all these thought patterns, and underneath there, you know, the wanting mind was creating the story of wanting the baked potatoes based on these sense doors. So the first input was the smell of the baked potatoes, and then the confirmation of the sight of the baked potatoes. And then the mind proliferated, going on and on with mental elaborations, kind of getting stuck in this loop around the baked potatoes. And so this whole host of emotions went through. You know, I was angry, I was sad. You know, I think there was a sense that the potatoes were meant for me. You know, somehow or rather, there was so many times that I had been left out, came up. And then I could also feel that righteous indignation. I was, still am, Irish. I know about potatoes. You're not supposed to be having them, you know? You should be having soup for your light meal, potatoes. And, you know, and that feeling that you can feel when you get self-righteous about knowing, I know how things should go. And then you can realize that this is all these patterns. These are the patterns of what it means to be human. This is who I am. This is a feeling of anger. This is a feeling of self-righteousness, and they flow through us. And one of the amazing things about having the continuity of mindfulness that I was able with this practice to not totally get lost, so that you can see there was a lot of proliferation there. But I didn't get lost in all of the stories. I saw them coming and arising and seeing the force of greed. And ultimately, I knew that having the baked potato wasn't going to solve the problem. But getting what I wanted, what Pema Chodron spoke to earlier, was actually not what was happening. That underneath this place of like me being worthy of needing a baked potato and feeling into that, because after I passed through the dining hall, I felt this tremendous sense of unworthiness in my body. And I thought I was going into a huge depression. And then I realized, oh, this is a pattern. This is a deep-seated pattern of unworthiness that leads to depression. And this is what it feels like in the body. And then when I could see that I was no longer caught, I could just allow that to be in me without the names and the stories. And that wouldn't have happened unless I had upheld the precepts of Sila, because I had taken the 8 precepts. And so if I were just like, oh, cool, forget the 8 precepts and I'm going for the potato bar and gone for that external pleasant, when I'm sure it would have been nice, you know, if I had gone for that momentary external pleasure, I wouldn't have gone through this process of really understanding how deep-seated was that sense of sadness and not belonging in me, that I could feel and get a sense of how that arose and begin to unbind the knots that were holding me there. And so I bring this story in because we don't have to have big moments of awakening. It can happen at any time and I don't think this is a big awakening, but it was a loosening for me of this way of clinging that was arising in these knots and these habit patterns of not being good enough, of not caring, and all of this stuff that lived in my body. And this comes from inclining the heart and mind in the direction of liberation. So paying attention to and reflecting on our actions and our speech and our words. And so in this sutta, I find it so useful because the Buddha shares how to train the body, the speech and mind to practice, to incline ourselves towards non-greed and generosity, non-hatred and loving kindness, and non-delusion wisdom in this gentle way where he's telling Rahula, at any point, beginning, before, during, or after, we have the capacity to reflect and change. It's this way that we can free the heart and mind from these forces that we all have, forces that keep us on the wheel of suffering. It's not my force of greed or your force of hatred or the confusion. These are the forces that run through all of us. So we're cultivating this practice to be with what arises. So we all have these seeds, as Mary Grace was telling us, that we can water these seeds to blossom in this way and attend to ourselves with care and kindness. And not only attending to ourselves, but the Buddha encouraging us to look at self, other, and both, recognizing our interconnectedness, not just the other and caring for others, which some of us are very good at, not just ourselves, which others of us may be better at, but the both. And so ending with a quote from the Dhammapada, which is a summary of this in another way. Avoiding all unskillful, cultivating the good, and cleansing one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So bringing in the skillful, avoiding those things upon reflection that we know are going to lead us the ways that will cultivate greed. And then also cleansing one's own mind internally with our mindfulness and intentions toward practice and with sila, holding ourselves in this practice. So I hope that in this teaching tonight, sharing a little bit of the stories and of what the Buddha and Son Rahula, that you have some ideas for how to work with this practice of wise reflection. So as we are mindful of something arises, we can bring in this non-judgmental awareness to help guide us towards creating this freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion that is so vitally needed in our world. So thank you for your kind attention. So we have a 30-minute period of movement, walking, and we'll be back for our metta meditation in 30 minutes. Thank you.